Morning. Ready for a few more? I know we sort of look and you're like, okay, there's 2 days left and 4 domains to go. But remember, the way ISC Squared has done this is the real heavy domains have been up front. Remember, domain was 200, domain one was 200 slides. We had 180, 160. Domain five is going to be about 70 slides, which is identity and access management. Then domain six, which is security testing, is actually only about 40 slides. Then domain seven, which is security operations, is another 150. But then domain eight, which is software development, is only about 50. So we're actually in good shape here. Our plan is to get identity and access management knocked out, get security testing knocked out, and get into some security operations this afternoon. That's going to then lead us to have hopefully somewhere around the 130, 140 slides tomorrow with two quizzes, which should put us in really good shape there. So that's sort of our game plan. We are tracking very well, but I just like bringing up the obvious because I know some of you are looking at, okay, in course days, we're three quarters of the way through, but in domains, we're only half. That's just the weighting they've given with that. Remember, don't fear the reaper, right? And yes, I am a drummer. So if you start falling asleep with me, I will bring in a cowbell tomorrow. So we'll start doing some cow. And you can ask my kids. I will do that if they do not get up in the morning or they are grumpy in the morning. I do walk in their room and do some Blue Oyster Cult cowbell with them. Yeah, so I wake him up. Yeah, that's the incentive to cooperate with that. And it's funny, my wife always goes, why are the kids so much more cooperative for you in the morning than me? I'm like, because I will cowbell them if they aren't. So it's amazing the power. We do not do a comprehensive quiz. That is what my recommendation is going to be, is sometime next week or next weekend before you take the exam, I want you to sit down and take all 320 questions at once. The problem is to do a comprehensive exam is 6 hours, and that's an entire day, and making this a 7-day class to do that, I don't think many of you would be happy. So that's the take-home exercise. One of the first things I'm going to have you do is block out 4 to 6 hours sometime over the next 10 days and sit down and take all 320 questions together. That's going to sort of be the getting ready for the marathon type to see how you're doing, where your issues are, and that's going to be my top recommendation. I'm going to do one thing better. I'm going to email you soft copies of the quizzes and the answer key, so you can basically print them out, retake them as many times as you want. So we used to give you a second copy, but then people say, hey, can I have a third? So now it's easier just to give it to you in soft copy, and then you can go to town on those quizzes, print them out, retake them, review, or do the analysis. So let's go ahead this morning and jump in to domain five. Hopefully you all got the little OSI model cheat sheet, courtesy of Chris, that he put together. I will be weaving this in to the lectures as we go through the next four domains, but this sort of gives you a good breakdown of the seven layers, brief explanation, some of the key protocols, and how we go in and refer to the data units at each of the respective levels. So keep this handy, but I'm going to be using this to reinforce that information as we go through the next 2 days. Any other questions, comments, concerns? All right, then. Remember, we are going to do a working lunch today. I'm going to get some pizzas brought in from the hotel. If for some reason you have any dietary restrictions, please let Max know. And if you need a salad or something different, no worries. Just ask him for that. We'll throw it on and I'll pick that up. So if for some reason you can't eat pizza, then just pick something else, salads or anything else that works for you, and we'll make sure everyone's happy there. main five, which is identity and access management. So in domain five, we're going to go in and revisit our AAA, authentication, authorization, and accountability. Now remember, it's really IAAA, because you identify yourself, and then you authenticate against who you identify to be. Then authorization is what are you allowed to do, and then accountability is tracking your actions. Then ISC Squared feels that it's important enough that they actually break biometrics now out into its own section. That is one of the four authentication methods. Remember, the four ways we authenticate is something you know, a password, something you have a token, something you are biometrics, and some place you are, physical location or IP address you're coming from. But because passwords are having challenges, they're actually going in and making biometrics a second area of using something you are to be able to authenticate, verify, and validate. And we'll look at some of the ways you verify the accuracy of those systems by looking at false acceptance rate, false rejectors rate, and the crossover error rate. Then we also look a little bit at the concept of SSO, or single sign-on. Then one of the new areas they added in that's becoming a bigger area is this idea of federated identification. How do you go in and have a universal identifier? So instead of having to go in and have all these different accounts, how can you have one account that's federated and monitored for all your different systems? An example of a federated ID is if any one of you have a Apple iCloud account, you would use that to go in and log into your iTunes, log into your application, log into your iCloud, log into all your different areas. Microsoft's doing the same with their MSN account. If you have an MSN account, I would use that one identity to be able to access my blogging site, access Facebook, access Twitter, access all my different areas there. So that's becoming a big, hot area. But as you can imagine, it's also becoming a high-risk area, because now if that ever gets compromised, they have a lot of access to a lot of information. And then we finally finish up by looking at how we can implement and manage authorization. That's where we're going to revisit our triad of least privilege, separation of duties, rotation of duties. We always go in and give somebody the least amount of access they need to do their job. If the least amount of access is too high a risk, we then split it up over two or more parties. Then if those two parties work together day after day, week after week, month after month, the fact that their checks and balances, they're going to become friends, they're going to get closer, and it erodes over time. So to reduce the risk of collusion, we're going to do rotation of duties. So notice how I'm linking terms together. That's deliberate. I want in your mind on the exam, when you see authorization, I want you to think least privilege, separation of duties, rotation of duties. When you see least privilege, I want you to think separation and rotation. I want you to link those, because that's going to be how you start getting the correct answers on the exam when you're making the linkages that ISC Squared wants you to have. So let's go ahead and begin our journey with identification, with identification, authentication, authorization, and accountability. So we look off, ISC Squared is big on life cycles. We don't just want to go into our enterprise and randomly do things. We want to have a life cycle approach where we systematically go in to accomplish a task. So if we look at our account provisioning life cycle, it's basically four components. Account administration, which is sometimes known as the onboarding process. Might want to write that down. It is in your notes, but I want to highlight the key concepts. account administration is sometimes known as the onboarding process. Then you have maintenance, where you're maintaining the account, monitoring, where you're analyzing what they're doing, and then revocation, where you remove their access once they leave. Revocation is sometimes known as the offboarding process. So onboarding is the initial account administration, and then offboarding is the revocation of those accounts. So let's look at each of these in a little detail. Account administration is when you hire somebody, you set up their account, you determine their job position, you give them the initial access, and you get everything ready for them to be able to work. Account administration usually works very well. Why? If you're the hiring manager and somebody shows up on day one to do their job and they can't access the system, what are you going to do as a manager? You're going to make some calls. You're going to scream and yell. You're going to make a little noise, and you're going to get that fixed. So because account administration impacts the revenue capability of a company, usually getting the initial account set up with the initial access does happen fairly well. Then we deteriorate very quickly. Maintenance. Just because you needed this access on day one, do you still need this access on day 30, day 100, day 200? Now, this is an area where I don't know why we don't do what we have accomplished in every other area of our lives. Question. Do driver's licenses last forever? No, they expire. Do credit cards last forever? No, they expire. Do passports last forever? No, they expire. Do access badges last forever? No, they expire. Does access to data last forever? Yes. Huh? I'm sitting there going, why are we not putting expiration dates on our access? We are doing this in every other area to control and limit exposure. Why are we not doing it here? So the best way to control and maintain proper access is by expiring access to information. So from an exam perspective, if you get a question where they're asking you what's one of the best methods for maintaining access, it is put expiration dates on that access. But Eric, what if I need access longer? What if you need your driver's license longer? What do you need if you need your credit card longer? What if you need your passport longer? You renew it. So you would renew the access. Because the problem we have with most companies is we have what we call the sticky principle. And the sticky principle is this. We keep adding access, but we never remove access. And I'm sure you've all seen this. You get hired at a company, and you're given base access. Then you get put on a new project, so access gets added. Then you get promoted, more access gets added. Then you get put on new projects, more access gets added. You probably know somebody at your company who's been there for 25 years and has access to everything because they've held so many job positions. We keep adding, and never removing. So expiration dates is a natural way to be able to go in and control and maintain the access that's needed. Monitoring. There is no such thing as an unstoppable adversary. If you are monitoring and watching access, there will always be anomalies and differences between normal user access and how attacks access the system. For example, users typically log in during the day. Adversaries, because they don't want to get caught, will typically log in off hours when people are not typically watching. Users will typically have a small number of failed access attempts. Most users only access information they need to do their job. Most adversaries will do internal recon where they're walking your data stores and typically will have a huge increase in the number of failed attempts to try to see what you have access to. So if you have a user account for 7 weeks, had 3 to 5 failed access attempts a week, and this week they have 2,000, something's happened. Right? Something occurred. We need to examine and understand why an anomaly occurs, and usually it's because of some adverse activity. So by monitoring and looking for anomalies, we're going to be able to catch advanced attacks. I will cover this in domain 7, but just want you to be clear. To catch traditional attacks, you look for signatures. To catch advanced attacks, you look for anomalies. So you're going to need to know that for the exam. If the exam gives you what do we do to look for traditional known attacks, that's going to be a signature. That's a pattern of activity that we're going to look for associated with a known attack. To catch advanced, unknown, zero-day attacks, you will not be able to get a signature because you've never seen the attack before. But anomaly detection will allow you to catch those attacks. So important concepts, I cover it later, but reinforced learning, want to make sure you have that known attacks signature, advanced unknown zero-day attacks, anomaly detection. Then when somebody leaves the company, you must remove all their access. As soon as they determine or you determine that they're going to no longer be employed at the company, you need to go in and remove all that access. Companies do a great job of making sure people don't get paid after they leave, making sure they don't have physical access after they leave, but they do a terrible job with cyber access. We've seen many cases where accounts are still active for years upon years upon years. So now we get into one of the best ways to control and manage security is by control and managing and monitoring what you have access to. So it's often referred to as AAA, but it's often IAAA. You identify, then you authenticate and prove you are who you say you are. Then what are you allowed to do on the system? What are you authorized to do? And then how do we track, monitor, and hold you accountable for your actions? Once again, one of the things I like doing for the exam is use non-cyber examples. Why? Most of you work in cyber. Most of you have experience in cyber. So if you use a cyber example, what are you likely to do? You're likely to apply it to how it's being done in your current job. What's the problem when you take a question and use your current job as the example? You are bringing in additional components and influences and biases that will naturally change the question and naturally get you to the wrong answer. You've seen this week. A few folks, when they went to the quiz, said, I picked a different choice. And they went in and said, well, in my job, we do X, Y, and Z. And they said, you're absolutely correct. What you just said, the answer is C. But read the paper. That's not what the question said. You changed the question. So that's why I do not like you using personal experience on the exam, because it's going to naturally bias you, add discriminators that are not there, and cause you to get it wrong. So I always joke, your worst enemy on the exam is this. Typically, when people overthink and overanalyze is when you start getting yourself into trouble. Keep it straightforward on the discriminators. So I like using non-traditional examples because that helps keep you honest on the exam. So let's look at when you travel. If you're flying home tomorrow night or Sunday, when you go to the airport, you're going to walk up to the ticket counter and you're going to identify yourself. You're going to say, hi, I'm Eric Cole, and I'm flying to Chicago. At that point, you've claimed to be a certain entity. So they're going to start typing into their computer. However, before they give you anything, don't they have to prove that you really are Eric? Couldn't anybody go to the airport and say they're Eric going to Chicago. Yes, so identification is fairly weak, so we need a verification. Authentication is proving you are who you say you are. So you give them your driver's license, which will verify and validate that you are Eric Cole. Then, once they prove you are who you say you are, do they give you a boarding pass to get on any flight? No. Do they give you a boarding pass to get on any flight to Chicago? No. They give you the least amount of access you are authorized to have, and that will be one flight at one gate at one specific time. So they give you the minimal amount of access you are authorized or entitled to have. So one of the terms, authorization, is sometimes referred to as user entitlement. What are you entitled to have in order to perform your job? So you give the least amount of access that's needed. Then when you get on the airplane, do they just look at your boarding pass? No. They scan it into the computer system, so now they can have a formal record of who is on that airplane. They hold you accountable. They now are accounting for where you are, and they are accounting for everyone on that airplane and can go in and use that to monitor and check that against check bags or other information or details. So that sort of shows you each of the steps and how they work. Identification is somebody claiming to be a certain entity. It's fairly weak in terms of enforcement because anybody can claim anything. Now, identification is broken down into two components, positive and negative. Positive identification is matching you against a specific individual. So when I walk up to the counter and I say, I am Eric Cole, that is positive identification. Positive identification is claiming to be a specific entity, and then we are going in and matching up against that entity. Negative identification is determining whether you are or are not part of a general group or category. So when I walk up to the ticket counter and I say, I am Eric Cole, they are doing positive identification. When I go home tomorrow night and I swing by 7-Eleven to pick up a six-pack of beer, because after this class, right, we definitely need that. When I walk up to the cashier, do they really care whether I am Eric Cole or not? No, they care whether I am in the category of somebody under the 21 or over 21. That is negative identification. So if they go in and they ask me for my birthday or they ask for my driver's license, they're not caring whether I'm Eric or not. They're just looking at my birthday to see whether I'm somebody above or below. So that's an example of negative identification, is if they're just trying to see if you're in a general category of individual or folks. So if you buy alcohol or cigarettes, they are basically doing negative identification against you. Now, identification is critical for the AAA process because you need to have a claim that you're validating against. I just can't walk up and say, hello, give me every boarding pass. Right? You need a starting point. So the identification is your starting point for issuing, checking, verifying, validating, tracking, and auditing who somebody is. Typically, when we do positive identification, that is your unique identifier. That's going to uniquely identify you to track and hold you accountable for those actions. Then you're going to go in, and typically the second step is authenticate. You prove that you are who you say you are. And then you go in, and what are you authorized to do? What are you authorized? I don't know why ISC squared puts these backwards, but they often put authorization and then authentication, but that's not how it systematically works. You always identify, then authenticate, prove that you are who you say you are, and then what are you authorized to do on the system? So authorization is our triad. Least privilege, Separation of duties, rotation of duties. What is the least amount of access you need to do your job? If that risk is too great, then we separate it between two or more parties. And then to minimize collusion, we do rotation of duties. So authorization is about giving you the minimal access required to perform your job. What are you entitled to have access to perform a given job function? It would be more, remember, you're getting more into the authentication when you're swiping a card. So the negative identification would be if they were visually looking at folks. So let's say that you work in a factory and somebody shows up with a three-piece Armani suit on. You know, the guard's probably going to go in and pull you out of the crowd and probably talk to you and want to find something because you're clearly not fitting within the group or the profile that should be going in to a factory. So it's more identification where claiming to be part or not part of a certain group or entity. I would just remember, honestly, don't overthink it. Remember the buying alcohol or buying cigarettes. That's going to be the best one for the exam. It's going to always get you the right answer. So stick with the simple one. Don't sort of try to overthink it, make it too complicated. And with your example, you were starting to bring in other components that could potentially get you to a bad spot. So remember, authorization is tied closely to least privilege, and least privilege is tied closely to separation of duties, and separation of duties is close tightly to rotation of duties. So we want to always put those together. Then authentication is basically verifying your identity. You said you are Eric Cole. Prove it. Prove that you really are that person. And remember, authentication is really based on four potential things. Something you know, password. Something you have, token. Something you are, biometrics. Or some place you are, location you're coming from, which could be an IP address or a specific location. And that is one of the newer ones from an IC squared perspective. Now remember, for the exam, they are asking you to do requirements-driven analysis. They are not asking for your opinion of whether you think something is stupid or ridiculous or not. So do not go in and change the question because you don't like the question, you don't agree with the question, or you think the question is silly or stupid. So if you get back to my example early in the week, an amazing geological discovery occurred in the Amazon. They found magic stones that can be used to uniquely identify individuals. Because your company is a cutting-edge technology company, you have decided to use these magic stones to authenticate your employees. Which of the following is the strongest method to implement this within your organization? A, something you know. B, something you know and something you are. C, something you have, or B, someplace you are. Correct answer is C. Excellent. Because the question is saying something in your possession, C is something you have. But Eric, B was two items, and it said pick the strongest one. Yes, C is the strongest one. B doesn't meet the requirements. B doesn't meet the requirements. B is something you know and something you are. The question is talking about something you have. So therefore, B doesn't meet the question. Therefore, C is the correct answer. Don't make the fatal mistake that assuming two is always stronger than one. That is false. If it doesn't meet the requirements of the question, it's not stronger. Now, what is the only exception to that? What is the only time where two is stronger than one? If there's an overlapping element. So now, if B was something you are and something you have, and C was something you have, now what would be the better choice? Now you would pick B, because B and C both meet the requirements. They both have an overlapping element of something you have. And now if B has something with that and C is by itself, then B would be the stronger answer. So the only time you can ever say two is stronger than one, if there's an overlapping element on those items. And also, if the question says anything you have to remember, if the question gives you anything involved with a location, if the question gives you anything involved with a human attribute, if the question gives you anything with something you have in your possession, you can't say those are distractors. Those are always going to be discriminators. Because that's the other mistake I've had students do, is they go, well, Eric, magic pebbles are stupid, therefore that was a distractor, so I didn't use that, and that's why I picked B. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Remember, you can't randomly decide. Something is only a distractor if it doesn't apply to the question. Something in your possession absolutely applies to authentication and is absolutely a discriminator. So when I talk about distractor, discriminator, you have to be able to recognize, is it applicable to the topic area? You can't just randomly decide what is and what isn't. If they went in and told you that your company was a $50 million organization that had 30% growth, yes, that's a distractor. Why? Money and growth is not a criteria for picking authentication. So because those are not a criteria, those are distractors. But magic stones is something you have, and that is critical, and therefore that becomes a discriminator. So being able to selectively and correctively go in and say what is and what is not discriminated distractors is based on what is relevant to the question being asked. Something you know is the simplest. Why? You don't need any additional hardware. What is the only hardware needed to implement something you know? A brain, and most people have one of these. Now remember, I didn't say everyone uses it, but everyone does have one of these. So something you know is easy and simple because it's built into every OS and there's no additional expenses that are required in order to implement it. It's usually accomplished through a password or a PIN or something you have to remember. Now, what's the weakness or issue with something you know? If it's something that I have to remember, it often doesn't change that frequent, and somebody could also guess it. People can go in and remember easy things that are easy to guess. Also, they could write it down, or they could tell it to other people. So because it is simple to implement, it's also easy for an attacker to be able to guess, break in, or compromise. Now, something you have is based off of having some physical access, a token, an access card, something physically in your possession. It can be an access card that you swipe to open a door. It could be a token that generates a new password every 60 seconds. Now, what's nice about something you have is an adversary can't easily go in and guess it, but the drawbacks of something you have is it is expensive. I have to go in and buy whatever that is you have for every person who needs access, and then what if they lose it? We have to replace it, update it, so there's a cost and an overhead and a maintenance function. Also, an adversary can steal it. So if an adversary goes in and steals your token or access card, now they would be able to impersonate you. Therefore, what do we often do to overcome the weaknesses and limitations of something you know and something you have, we often implement two-factor or multi-factor authentication. If any of you have an RSA token or similar item, how do you authenticate? You enter in a four-digit PIN, something you know, and then you enter in the six digits off the token. So now, even if somebody guesses my PIN, they don't have the token. And if somebody steals my token, they don't have the PIN. So that's why those two naturally fit together, because they both have weaknesses. And by doing two-factor authentication, overcomes the weaknesses inherent with each one of those items. Then something you are is biometrics, which is based on a physical human attribute. No, because remember, the question was, is two things you know multi-factor? No, because that's a long password. That's basically just a long password. Now, technically, two different access cards, because somebody would have to steal both, technically is a two-factor. But on the exam, when they talk about two-factor and multi-factor, they're referring to two different techniques together. So if they talk about two passwords, that is not technically multi-factor. From an exam perspective, it has to be two different categories for it to count. Something you are is biometrics. It's based on a physical human attribute. Your hand scan, your fingerprint scan, your facial scan. Now, the nice thing about something you are or biometrics is it's pretty hard for somebody to steal. Now, contrary to Hollywood movies, where they go in and cut off your hand or pop out your eyeball or those fun things, those do not work because new biometrics today require signs of life. So you actually have to be alive for it to work, which means it took an hour and 45 minutes to get into this movie to find something that was realistic and accurate. But this was the one accurate and realistic part of the movie, G.I. Joe. So if you've watched the movie G.I. Joe, it took an hour and 45 minutes to get to an accurate component. And that component was they had their super top secret research facility under the pyramids in Egypt. Remember, I said highly realistic movie. And the bad guys broke in at the very end to go in and steal that top secret that was in a safe. And when the bad guys got to the general who was in charge of the facility, the one bad guy shot him in the leg. And the other guy said, "Why don't you just kill him?" And he said, "I need to keep him alive so the biometric authentication will work to open up the safe." And I finally started cheering in the movie theater. The reason why my family won't go with me, because I'm like, finally, we got a realistic part of that movie, right? It was true. If they killed him, then his biometric would not have worked anymore. So they had to keep him alive to do that. So newer biometrics require signs of life. Also, I can lose my token. I can forget my token at home. I can forget my password. I don't forget my hand, my face, or my eye at home. It's always with me. So that's the other benefit of biometrics. The drawback of biometrics is typically it doesn't change that often. So that means that if my company grabs my biometric data and I leave after a year, they can technically still track me for the next 20 years. Also, biometric information can also violate PII or PHI. Do you realize doing an iris scan can actually be used to determine cholesterol, heart rate, pregnancy, and other factors? And there have been companies that have had massive lawsuits because they basically were using the biometric authentication data to get into the facility in order to go in and determine promotability of employees. So, for example, there was one case where an employee was up for promotion, and they didn't give it to him because the biometric data showed that he had major, major health conditions, major, major health issues, and they did not think he was going to be around for a long time because of his health issues, and didn't give him the promotion. The one that made it in the news was a certain government agency used biometric data to basically go in and determine whether females were pregnant and use that to determine deployment and who got what promotions. You can't do that, right? I don't know who thought that was going to end well. I mean, that's one of those things. You got to be sitting in the meeting when you're making that decision, and you got to just say, there is no scenario where this ends well. I mean, there's no possible way this could have ever ended positive. And then, of course, when it leaks out, they're like, well, yeah, we didn't think this would be such a big problem. Really? I would have respected you more if you said, yeah, we were stupid, right? And we should not have done it, right? So companies have got themselves in a lot of trouble there. Also, biometric readers are very expensive to deploy. So now if you're using biometrics and you need people to authenticate from home, they need a biometric reader at home. They need a biometric on every device they're authenticating to. Eric, sorry about that. I just wanted to finish that one thought. Yeah, that's something. Remember, we introduce biometrics here, and then in about 25 slides, I have a whole section on biometrics. So the crossover error rate is you basically have two calculations, the FAR, the false acceptor rate, and the FRR, the false reject rate. And when the FAR and the FRR meet, that's your crossover error rate, and that's how you measure the accuracy of a biometric system. And we're going to cover all of that in about 20 slides, go into details on that. We're just sort of introducing the concepts. Then we have some place you are, which is traditionally based on where you're coming from or the machine you're coming from. So, for example, if you go to a credit card site and it will go in and look at the source IP address you're coming from, if they have never seen a connection from that source IP address, they will take you through a whole enrollment process. You got to enter in a ton of information, it'll do a lot of things to prove you are who you say you are. Then they record that location or IP address or system. Then if you come back from that system, you only have to enter in a user ID and password. If you come from a different location, you then have to re-enter it again. This creates, of course, lots of issues for me who travels for a living. So I go in and work remotely. Every time I'm at a new location, I have to re-authenticate all of that info because I'm coming from a different place each time. Also, the traditional deployment of someplace you are is global positioning system, where you actually have a GPS locator in your computer. So a simple example of this, if you are within a government building that's authorized to process classified information, you can decrypt the data. If you're not in one of those locations, you can't. So they actually will have systems that if you bring a laptop home, there's certain information that based on your physical location, you will not be able to decrypt or access the data. But if you bring it into an authorized office, you would then be able to do so. Now, it can be used in different areas, but typically when you're talking about the GPS physical location, that's typically going to be in a classified environment. That's typically in classified environments. Also, someplace you are is typically not authenticating a person. It's authenticating a location or system. So you typically use this in two-factor authentication. You typically don't go in and just use someplace you are by itself. You're going to usually use it with a password or a PIN or some other components there. Because otherwise, if all they're doing is basing it on that location or on that IP address, somebody just steals your computer. And somebody's in if they get to that spot. So that's not what we want. So someplace you are, GPS is usually works with classified environments. IP is normally an additional protection measure with banks or e-commerce, but it is a typically secondary measure for two-factor. It's typically not used independently. We have two questions. So when you go in and you look at how these banks are working, it's typically usually three-factor. They're looking at the IP address, so it's a location. They're checking your cookie to make sure it's valid, something you have. And then they also go in and ask for a password, something you know. So they're typically doing all three of those on the system. If they were just looking at your packet and looking at the source IP address, then that would only be some place you are. But because they're then placing a cookie on your system that you have to present back also, that is something you have. If you're going in and using it for authentication or access. So yes, in an ISC squared, if you're going in and you're using that to verify whether somebody can or cannot access information and you're filtering on IP addresses, that would be classified as a someplace you are, because IP addresses are in general, public IP addresses are positional. You can tell the general area. So for example, what some companies will do, which I think is where Kirk's going, is if I'm only a U.S. company and I only work in the U.S., my firewalls will filter out foreign IP addresses. So if you're coming from a foreign IP, I block you. If you're coming from a U.S. IP, I allow you in. That's authenticating on some place you are and would be a valid example of that. Yes, you're seeing a lot more implementation of this as a secondary additional measure, because it's just one more thing to make it harder for the adversary. We talked about cookie stealing the other day. So somebody can potentially go in and steal your cookie. Somebody can potentially go in and steal your password. But going in and finding out your IP address and two-way spoofing an IP address is extremely, extremely difficult to do. Want to clarify. One-way spoofing is easy. So if I want to go in and I want to do a denial of service attack and make it look like it's coming from someone else, it's easy for me to flood you with packets, spoof my source IP address because there's no validation, and make it look like it's coming from Max. That's easy. The problem is, if I send a packet to George, who's our banking server, and I spoof my IP address to be Max, where are the replies going? Back to Max, not to me. So it's a one-way connection. To spoof Max's IP address to George and get the information to come back to me is where it becomes a little trickier and harder to be able to do that. So that's why they're adding that in as an extra level of protection.